Welcome to the Kitchen Counter Podcast, Episode 5, Five Favorites of Fall. Hey everybody, Roger here. Thank you so much for downloading and listening to this episode of the Kitchen Counter Podcast. This is the show that is dedicated to helping aspiring home cooks grow their skills and confidence in the kitchen so they can start cooking up memories with family and friends. And that's really what we're all about here is I want to get you into the kitchen cooking. Whether you're a first timer in the kitchen, brand new, or you've been doing it for a while, I think you'll find something of value in the podcast. And of course, I'm always looking to hear from you. So if you have any questions or comments or show ideas, or you just want to get in touch, you can send me an email at feedback@kitchencounterpodcast.com. You can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/kitchencounterpodcast. And you can also connect with me on Twitter at TKCpodcast. Well, for this episode, I thought I would get back to talking a little bit more about food and recipes. In the last episode, episode 4, Better Safe Than Sorry, I took a slight detour from that, and I talked a lot about food safety in the home kitchen because that's an important topic. And the question had come up on the Facebook page, and I thought it would just be a good opportunity to, you know, address some of those questions and go down that path. So in the future, if you ever need to reference food safety stuff, I recommend you just go to thekitchencounterpodcast.com/4 and you'll get to the show notes for last week's episode. That being said, for this episode, any links or recipes or the full show notes, if you're interested, can be found at the website at kitchencounterpodcast.com/5. Well, today we're talking fall dishes. And I mentioned a couple episodes ago that fall was my favorite time of the year to cook because you kind of are coming back into the kitchen from the warmer summer months. You're making very different dishes. I mentioned, you know, you're probably barbecuing or eating salads or eating lighter food. But when the nights come sooner and the days and the mornings and the evenings are cooler, you kind of take a different approach to home cooking. At least I do where we live here in Oregon, because come October, the rain starts coming and going. The evenings do get cooler and we start getting out our casserole dishes and our crock pots and our Dutch ovens, and we're turning the oven on more and we're thinking about baking. It's just a completely different mindset when it comes to cooking. So I wanted to take a little bit of time today and talk about my five favorites of fall. What I did for this episode was to go through my recipes and my list and just in my mind and think, what are the five dishes that I tend to think about the most when fall rolls around? What are those first dishes that I want to break out from summer and get in the kitchen and make that really kind of warms you up in the evening in those chilly fall nights? And what are kind of those five dishes that really epitomize fall and that kind of change of season to me? So certainly not a comprehensive list. There's many, many, many more dishes that I could go on and on about, but I narrowed it down to five. I've got three main dishes and a couple of dessert baked type dishes. So we're going to go right down the list. And if your favorite is not on here, please tell me about it. Again, feedback@kitchencounterpodcast.com. Would absolutely love to hear from you. I'm going to jump right into the list. Number one, the number one dish I think about when fall rolls around, and it was actually maybe one of the first fall dishes I made this year, and that is chili. There's almost no other dish I can think of that means fall to me more than a good chili. If you're a football fan, maybe you're tailgating or you're going to football viewing parties, chili is the perfect get-together food. It's warm. It's easy to make in one pot. It's absolutely delicious when you bake up some cornbread to go with it. And one of the fun things about chili in my mind is that there's probably a different chili recipe for every person in the country. I'm sure you could Google chili recipes. You could get 365 of them and you could make a different chili recipe for every day of the year and you'd probably never even come close to repeating. The other great thing about chili is because of its versatility, because there's so many different ways you can make it, so many regional varieties, so many really new and interesting ways and new ingredients to put into chili, it can be easily adapted to anybody's dietary requirements or preferences. So tons of vegetarian, vegan chilies out there. Gluten-free, not really an issue with chili, so good there. Do you like your chili so spicy that your eyeballs melt out of your head? You can do that. Not really fond of tomatoes and you prefer maybe a green chili instead using maybe tomatillos and green peppers, you can do that too. So really, the sky is the limit when it comes to chili. There's so many recipes, and you could almost really just throw a bunch of ingredients in a pot with some chili powder and whip up a chili, and you probably wouldn't even go wrong. But the recipe I'm sharing today is kind of my go-to chili recipe, and this actually comes from my wife's side of the family. And this would be a chili con carne, or chili with meat, in this case, beef, ground beef. And it's kind of, you know, if I had to picture a bowl of chili in my mind's eye, this is just kind of the chili I think about. It would be the homemade version and a much, much better tasting version of the kind of chili you buy in a store in a can. You know, it's got a tomato sauce base, it's got beans, it's got beef, it's got that rich chili flavor. So if you're in need of a basic, standard, really delicious, and quite easy to make chili, go check out the recipe at kitchencounterpodcast.com/5. A couple of things when you're making chili to keep in mind, especially if you're new to working with spices or if you've never made chili before. Chili basically gets its name from one of the main spice ingredients that you put in it, which would be chili powder in most cases. But it's important to note that when a recipe, including the recipe I'm sharing today, when a recipe calls for chili powder, it's generally not calling for a spicy variety of chili powder. So in my recipe, I call for 2 tablespoons of chili powder. If that was spicy chili powder that you put in, that chili would be inedible, but to all but maybe a few people on earth. So you want to be careful when you're putting the chili powder ingredient into your chili that you're getting a regular chili powder blend. In most supermarkets, when you buy just a chili powder blend, it's very, very mild or not spicy at all. It's taking dried chilies that aren't spicy to make that powder. Now, most chili does have an element of spice to it, and some folks like it really spicy, so you do want to add another type of mechanism to add heat. And again, in the recipe I'm sharing, it's a little bit of cayenne powder. And cayenne is very spicy, nearly flavorless in my opinion. So if you are looking to add heat to a dish like this chili and you don't want to change the flavor profile too drastically, cayenne can do that for you. There's other ways to add heat. You could add chipotle powder. You could add chipotles and adobo sauce. You could add jalapenos, serranos. There's just a ton of different ways you can add heat. Typically, what I like to do, I like spicy food, but not everybody in my family does. My wife doesn't particularly like really spicy chili. She likes a little bit of spice. Or if you're making it for a group and you're not sure how everybody feels about really spicy food, it's generally better to err on the milder side and then have some condiments or add-ons that everybody can kind of customize their own bowl of chili. So when I make it at home, I make it on the mild side with just a pinch of cayenne, and then I add some hot sauce in or some extra chili powder into my bowl of chili to get it to the heat level that I like. So the golden rule really when it comes to adding spice to chili or any dish that calls for spice, hot spice, is that you can put it in, no problem. You can't take it out. It's really hard to take heat out of a dish. So always err on the side of milder if you're not sure what the tolerance level of the people eating your dish is. Now, I mentioned that my chili recipe takes beef. If you wanted to make this a vegetarian option, it would be really easy to add, to substitute some different types of beans, perhaps, for the beef. Or I bet what would be really fantastic would be some diced portobello mushrooms in place of the beef into that chili. That would make it nice and hearty, and I'm sure it would be fantastic. All right, so number one for me was chili. Let's go to number two, which is beef stew. Yes, when I was growing up, my mom would, you know, sometimes take a cheap, tough cut of beef, like an eye of round roast, you know, something that just without a lot of long, moist cooking is just going to turn out tough and chewy and not very flavorful. She'd brown it up. She'd toss it in a pot with some onions, some carrots, some diced potatoes, and let it stew in the oven with some liquid for a few hours. And basically what would happen is the house would end up smelling amazing, and you'd end up with this ultimate kind of one-pot meal. So you'd have all the vegetables have been cooking in the broth, and they're nice and tender, and the flavoring from the meat and the broth has kind of infused them, and the meat will cook in that long, slow, moist environment, and it gets really tender and kind of shreds and falls apart and kind of melts in your mouth. And that's, you know, one way you're going to take a tough cut of meat and make it delicious. And it was often quite a treat when she did this because, you know, to my recollection, I think in our household when I was growing up, the protein of choice was generally pork. So pork chops, pork roasts, that sort of stuff, because it was a cheaper variety of protein. Beef was and still is even getting more expensive. So when she opted for beef, if beef was on sale or she got a good deal from the store, the butcher, that was kind of a treat. Now, I still sometimes make beef stew like my mom used to make, where I just take a roast, if you will, and some potatoes and onions and carrots. And you might call that a roast in the oven. The difference, I would say, is if you're putting some liquid in to kind of make a gravy, that kind of turns it into a stew. But what I like to do, is I've modified that a bit. I've kind of found my own method of making stew that I really, really like. And what I'll do is I'll take, again, kind of a tough cut of meat. And I like to cut those into kind of maybe a little bit larger than bite-sized chunks. And for the liquid, I use a combination of beef stock or broth and like a really strong red wine to stew the meat. And I put in some carrots with that. And then for the potatoes, rather than cooking them in the stew pot with the meat and the carrots, I like to whip or mash those up separately. And then what you end up with this is kind of a mashed potato dish with this really, really rich gravy that has been cooked down with that red wine and that stock and the carrots and the beef. And you can just basically take that and spoon that over the top of the mashed potatoes. And it's really such a fantastic dish. In fact, I think my stomach's growling right now thinking about it. And the mashed potato aspect of it shouldn't scare you. Mashed potatoes are actually quite easy to make. I know sometimes it's easy to go to the store and pick up a package of the, you know, the Idahoan instant potato flakes or whatever. And you know what? In a pinch, that's totally fine to do. But, you know, mashed potatoes are not that tricky to make. I'll include a couple of links for some really simple mashed potato recipes in the show notes. And if you don't feel like potatoes, if it sounds like too much work, or if you just want something different, this dish would really go good with some extra wide egg noodles, almost like a beef stroganoff sort of a thing. So you could do that as well, and that would be really delicious. All right, moving on down the list to number 3, chicken and dumplings. To me, chicken and dumplings are a quintessential comfort food. Even the words chicken and dumplings, I mean, don't they just sound comforting and cozy? I thought about including maybe chicken pot pie in this slot instead, which is also a fantastic dish, but the level of difficulty for chicken pot pie is quite a bit higher than it is for chicken and dumplings. Although the chicken and dumplings recipe is not necessarily easy, it's a lot easier than pulling off a chicken pot pie, which can take a lot of work, and you know, sometimes you put a lot of work into it and it doesn't quite deliver. But in a future episode, I will be tackling pot pies and we'll get some recipes out there to make it. But I want to talk about chicken and dumplings now. So the recipe that I've included in the show notes will look intimidating. There's a lot of ingredients in the list, but don't let that worry you. A lot of those ingredients are herbs and spices and things like that that you just need to kind of gather and put in the pot. Now, for me, the absolute key to making a killer chicken and dumplings is how you prepare the chicken ahead of time, because typically what you're going to do is you're going to pre-cook the protein. You're going to pre-cook the chicken that you're going to add to the pot of liquid and vegetables, and how you prepare that chicken ahead of time is going to go a long way to how the final dish is going to taste. I've seen recipes at, you know, internet recipe sites that call for boiling your chicken. You take some chicken breast, you throw it in a pot of water, maybe a little salt, garlic, whatever, and you boil it for, I don't know, a half an hour or whatever until the chicken is cooked through, and then you can take that chicken and shred it or whatever to put it in your dish. I'm here to tell you, or ask you, please don't boil your chicken. I can't think of a more flavor killing way to prepare a protein, especially chicken, than to boil it. Even if you put stuff in the water, boiling it is just not going to get the results you want. So what I like to do with chicken breasts in particular, if you need to cook these up ahead of time, is to sear off your chicken breasts in a saucepan or a saute pan, and then add a little bit of white wine, a little bit of chicken stock, maybe a sprig of rosemary, a couple of garlic cloves, put a cover on it, and just let the chicken breast simmer in that. You're going to end up with chicken that is packed full of much, much, much more flavor than just a hard-boiled chicken breast. Now, the other thing that makes this particular chicken and dumplings recipe kind of fun is, in some places I've had chicken and dumplings out in restaurants, the dumplings end up kind of being just like little dough clumps or fat little noodles almost in like a thick chicken soup. So the way these dumplings turn out is you'll actually mix up the mix, and then you take your pot with your simmering liquid, and you're going to drop the dumpling dough in by fat spoonfuls, and it's just going to sit on top of that liquid and cook. You're going to do it uncovered for a bit and then covered for a bit. But what happens is you get these ridiculously puffy, fluffy, almost like little baseball-sized clouds of dumpling dough that just cook up. And then when you dish it up, you get some of this nice chicken and vegetables and kind of the gravy. The liquid will thicken with the dumplings cooking in them. And there's just white, fluffy dumpling. And I like the dumplings plain, but you could even go and add anything you wanted to the dumpling dough to give it a little more flavor, like some dried thyme in the dumpling dough would be awesome. So chicken and dumplings, I highly recommend you add that to your fall recipe rotation. It's a little bit of work. It's a great Sunday evening dinner for family. Give it a try. Again, the recipe will be in the show notes. All right, so far I've covered the first three of my five dishes, and they've all been kind of main dish, savory. We had chili, we had beef stew, and then we had chicken and dumplings. So the next two dishes are going to venture into more of the dessert, more of the sweet realm, more of the baking realm. And I will mention, full disclosure right up front, I am not the baker in the family. There are very few limited things I can pull off when it comes to baking. My wife is really the star when it comes to baking, whether it's cake or pie or cookies or bread, whatever. She's really the authority in the household. But there are a couple of things I can do, and two of the things I can do I think are perfect for fall. Number four on my list of five favorites of fall is apple crisp. We live in apple country. So here in Oregon, when fall rolls around, if you don't have an apple tree on your property, if you don't know somebody that does, who will probably be more than happy to give you boxes and boxes of apples, every farmer's market, every supermarket has local apples in stock. And if it's not local Oregon apples, it's relatively local Washington State apples, which are great too. And the variety, it's almost an embarrassment of riches. There are so many varieties of apples, all with different properties, all with different flavors, all with different properties when you bake them. And while apple pie is kind of the ultimate apple dessert in my mind, it's kind of a summer dish. And quite frankly, as I mentioned with the chicken pot pie a moment ago, making an apple pie and making it turn out good is sometimes a monumental task. You have to mess around with finicky pie crust. You have to ensure that your pie isn't too liquidy, or it will ruin the your filling isn't too liquidy, or it will ruin the pie. So you can put a lot of work into putting together an apple pie. And at least in my experience, when I've tried it, the results usually don't live up to the expectations and the amount of work I've put into it. So there is an easier way to make a very simple apple dessert, and that's apple crisp. So with the recipe I've included for apple crisp, very simple. And, you know, when you serve it warm right out of the pie pan and you throw a dollop of vanilla ice cream on there, nobody's going to care that you didn't take the time to make an apple pie or some infinitely more complicated apple dessert. Now, apples aren't the only reason that this dish falls on my favorite fall list of recipes. it also uses what I like to call warm spices. So when I say warm spices, I don't mean spicy spices like cayenne pepper or chili powder or, you know, chili peppers. I mean kind of those spices that, well, I don't know how else to explain it, but warm. And that would be your cinnamon, your cloves, your allspice, your nutmeg, those spices that kind of, you know, maybe make up your pumpkin spice mixtures, your drinking your chai lattes. Those are the spices with some others that you're getting in that. So those are kind of the warm, cool evening warm spices that I think about. And in the recipe, you're going to be putting some of those into the apple crisp. And cinnamon, of course, is custom made for fall. That's when you start eating cinnamon dishes. So that's another big reason that it makes the list. And just one note about apples, and this goes for most apple desserts that you're going to be baking. You're going to want to try to get the right type of apple. So when you go to the farmer's market or you go to the grocery store, if they don't have some sort of a guide or signage that tells you what the apple is good for, ask. You're going to want kind of a more tart, a more firm apple. If you've ever eaten a Granny Smith apple, those are those really firm, tart green apples. Those are perfect for apple crisp and apple pie and baking because they hold up well. They don't turn to mush, and their flavor is strong enough that it doesn't get lost in the spices and the dish. So when in doubt, grab some Granny Smiths. You won't fail with those. All right. That was my first 4 out of 5, and we come to the final dish in the list. And this one, I really have a connection to, a lot of fond memories. This is a dish that my mom would make kind of for special occasions. So maybe not at the beginning of fall, but when Thanksgiving rolled around, she would have these on the table, and she would make cinnamon rolls. Now, the cinnamon rolls that my mom made are, and I should say that growing up, these are probably the only cinnamon rolls I ate, unless I ate some sort of a weird package thing, you know, Danish from the store. But as far as cinnamon rolls are concerned, I thought this is what cinnamon rolls were my entire life until, you know, I went to college or whatever, and I ordered a cinnamon roll somewhere, and it would come with this white, like, frosting on it, like a buttercream frosting or something. And I'd be like, that's not a cinnamon roll. That's like a cinnamony cupcake with frosting on it. So what I mean by that is when my mom would make cinnamon rolls, rather than frosting them, she would put together this mixture that I just call goo, and I mean that in the nicest possible way, of it would be heavy whipping cream and brown sugar, and she would heat that in a saucepan until the brown sugar kind of dissolved, and you'd end up with this kind of a creamy, sugary, caramely almost tasting mixture. And she would pour this in the bottom of a baking dish, and then she would set the cinnamon rolls, the unbaked cinnamon rolls, into the dish on their sides in this goo, and then pop it in the oven. Well, then what happens is after your rolls are done baking, you take the pan out of the oven, and then you just literally flip the whole pan over onto like a cookie sheet or some tin foil, and you'd end up with this block of cinnamon rolls that would drop out, and you'd have this goo just clinging and running and kind of soaking into the top of these cinnamon rolls on the other side. And let me tell you what, once you have a cinnamon roll like that, in my opinion, you're never going to go back to frosting. By the way, a couple of notes on the cinnamon roll recipe that I've included, which is my mom's recipe. I only modified it by adding, by upping the quantity of the goo just a little bit, because it's so good, you can almost never have too much of that stuff on your cinnamon rolls. But what I recommend doing, and what I call for in the recipe to save yourself a little bit of time, a little bit of headache, is to pick yourself up a box of Pillsbury hot roll mix. It's going to save you a little bit of time. And really all it is you're going to pay a little bit more, but you're not going to have to worry about finding flour, finding yeast, finding baking powder, all that kind of stuff. It's already in the box. It's already ready to mix up with some really easy to follow instructions. So do yourself a favor. It's not going to change the dish drastically if you don't find an equivalent recipe and make it from scratch. Just go pick up a box of hot roll mix. And also, you're going to want to look at the sugar and the cinnamon when you're making these rolls. And if you really, really like cinnamon, you're probably going to want to up the quantity a little bit. Or, you know, if you're a little sensitive to cinnamon, just dial it back a bit. So you can be a little off the cuff when it comes to the spices in these desserts. I mean, the quantity of cinnamon you put in is not going to affect, unless you totally coat the dough, it's not going to affect how these bake up. So you have a little bit of leeway with how that works. But I guarantee you, if you make up a batch of these cinnamon rolls around the holiday time, your family will go absolutely bonkers, and they'll want you to bake them again and again, which can be a mixed blessing, I suppose. But Mom's Gooey Cinnamon Rolls, again, the recipe is in the show notes at kitchencounterpodcast.com/5. You are going to love them. All right, well, that was my five favorites of fall. Just to run back through the list really quickly, at number one, we had chili. Then we went on to beef stew. And then we talked about chicken and dumplings, then apple crisp and cinnamon roll. So these five dishes, to me, really symbolize what fall means for the home cook. And recipes for each of these, again, is available at kitchencounterpodcast.com/5, along with other show notes and links of interest. I would absolutely love to hear from you what your favorite fall dishes are. And if you'd like to share a recipe, I'd love to get that from you, share it with our listeners and readers, and of course I'll give you credit for it, but it's a great way to get some recipes out and sharing the foods that bring family and friends together. If you want to email me some information, or if you'd just like to email me to let me know what your favorite fall dish is, I'll mention it on next week's show. feedback@kitchencounterpodcast.com is the email address to do that. I mentioned at the beginning of the show, you can find us on Twitter at TKC Podcast or Facebook at facebook.com/kitchencounterpodcast. If you are enjoying the show and you're getting some value out of it, I would love it if you would head over to iTunes and consider leaving a review for the show. It helps out. The more reviews we get, the more subscriptions we get from iTunes, it helps put us a little bit higher on the page when it comes to cooking and home cooking and things like that. So that helps more people find the show and it gets the word out. One last note before I wrap up. I will occasionally put links in the show notes to some products or items that I talk about in the show, and those links are to Amazon. Now, I want to let you know, and I want to be upfront about it, if you click on those links and you end up buying one of those products from Amazon, I get a tiny kickback for that, and that helps me put money back into the show because, you know, doing a podcast isn't free. There's equipment, there's hosting the files, there's website fees, things like that. So it helps out a little bit. I'm a big fan of local family-owned businesses, so I definitely would prefer you go and buy any products you need locally. But if you don't want to do that or you can't find what you need, consider checking it out through our website. You don't pay any more. Your experience doesn't change with Amazon, but again, we get a little bit of help for the show. Okay, enough of that. Thanks again for listening. I really appreciate it. I'm having a lot of fun putting these shows together. Again, if you have an idea or you have questions, I'd be happy to try to tackle. Send me an email. Until next time, I hope you get into the kitchen. I hope you pull out some recipes, maybe try something new, and make up some delicious food for your family and friends. And you know what? Just by doing that, you're going to make stories that you're all going to talk about years from now. And who knows, maybe one of your family members years into the future will be dedicating some time to put together a podcast to talk about the awesome food you made. So thank you so much. This is Roger for the Kitchen Counter Podcast. Until next time, thanks.